Welcome to episode 6, our final episode of the Soho Then Photo Base podcast. I'm Claire Lynch, audio producer and Soho resident. This programme consists of 6 themed episodes released monthly over 2018 and 2019. Each episode has a corresponding collection of photographs that you can scroll through as you listen. In this episode, we explore the topic of home and homelessness in Soho's past. Rena, Viola and Leslie are our guides, with contributions from former and present-day residents and workers sharing their memories of Soho from 20 or more years ago.
I was born in 62 Old Compton Street on the 7th of February in 1926. My name is Rena Rotondo.
I was born on 5th of February 1927, and I was born in the University College Hospital. My mother at that time lived in Goodge Place. And then we moved into my aunt's that lived in number 19 Peter Street. My name was Violet Florence Jones. And now it's Mrs. Violet Traite, T-R-A-Y-T-E.
Italy was a very poor country soon after the war. There were no jobs opportunities, so we all immigrated, especially from my neck of the woods. My name is Claudio Mussi, I'm 79. We came over here 21st of October 1961. The employers used to provide you with job and lodging.
And there was a woman called Mrs. Lee, and she lived in number 35 Great Poplar Street. My name is Leslie Hardcastle. I'm 92 next birthday. And she used to invite people to dinner, and she invited me to dinner. And I met all sorts of people in her house. And at the age of 65, she fell in love again. She just sent me a note saying, "You've always loved this flat. And I'm going to go and live in Paris. Would you like it?" And by foul means, I actually occupied the flat. She paid the rent to the Sir Richard Sunsettle Estates, who owned the building, and I paid her. And one day they found out that she didn't live there anymore, but that time I had actually established a tenancy. So that's how I started in Soho.
I moved to Soho in 1972 after I met Alan Wakeman. So we ended up having a flat and a shop in Piccadilly Circus, behind the lights.
I was offered a job making costumes and doing choreography for the Carnival Striptease Club, which was in Old Compton Street. I had a flat, a studio, and a lot of fun. It was a bit dodgy, a bit risky, but it was an eye-opener. And that was 1979.
My mum moved in here in October 1927. She didn't like living there. She wanted to come away, so she came into St. James's residence. And she was in these flats till she died.
When we lived here and we rented a place, I think they paid 5 shillings for one room. You used to go into the toilet at night, everybody in that one house. You had the basement, the parlour, first floor, second floor, then top floor. 2 rooms on each floor. Everybody had to share the toilet. If you wanted water, you had to get it on the landings, nowhere else. And the tin bath always used to be in an out of place in the downstairs. And the rats used to be running around.
The top floor of the Piccadilly restaurant, I used to sleep. One room with a meter in the corner where you used to put the odd penny in order to have electricity. There used to be a bath on the second floor. Again, we used to have to put pennies in the meter turn the meat in order to get the guests to have a hot bath. And practically this is it. We used to work 6.5 days a week for £6 a week. The restaurant was a snack bar at the time on Great Ormond Street.
When I used to go to the original number 35, you used to go to the front door and you meet a Greek tailor. He used to say, "The buttons, you don't call these buttons, they cannot make buttonholes, young people cannot make buttonholes." And I said, "Yes, yes, yes, yes." So I passed him, and then I would meet Bernie Levine, who'd say, "Did I ever tell you the time I saw Jack Spot stabbed? I was buying a cabbage in Old Compton Street, and he came in and he fell down, and I got blood on my cabbage." I've later found out that was a complete lie, because he was actually stabbed in a club. And then behind him, we had Oscar Oswald, the magician, who was an ex-policeman, used to sell tricks. And he blew up on a Saturday and nearly set the building on fire. But then you'd go up the stairs, and there were 5 pieces of Welsh slate screwed on the side of the building as an afterthought for a loo. And that was shared by these three people downstairs, ourselves, the people above us, and the people above them.
Now, when I came, my husband, he was living in Silver Place with his mother. But apparently they had to move because there was children over their head and the mother couldn't stand it. So the Sir Richard Sutton Estates gave them a place in number 13 in Gesta. So she had the top flat, which was 2 rooms, their own toilet on the landing, and the kitchen was out on the landing, if you understand what I mean, where they had the cooker. So her son had the back room for himself, and his mother had a put-you-up bed that she used to sleep in. And then when she died, we managed to get the flat.
Then you'd go into our room, which is a magnificent room. It was about 15 feet square and about 12 feet high. And one side of the room used to fold back shutters, and you used to go into the next room. And it's where they used to have receptions when it was a big house belonging to one person. But now you'd go in there and then you'd open the little folding door thing and you'd see our bed and then you'd see our sink and you'd see our bath and a piece of string with a curtain hiding the bathroom view, and then you'd see our kitchen. So it was really like that. And above us we had the Italian, the Agosti family, who used to have this fantastic row every Sunday, and crash, bang, "No, I'm going to leave. You're dominating me." The mother used to be very dominant, and she was a widow, and she used to say, "Your father wouldn't allow this." And actually it was a cartoon of the father on the wall, because he was a chef at the Savoy. And I said to this boy one day, "You know, well, are you going to leave?" "You know, yes, I'm going to leave." I said, "How old are you?" And he said, 48. And then above, there was a pilot, a comet pilot, and it was a pilot, only saw him occasionally. He always seemed to have a different wife every time he went up. So that was, and there was like that, the whole lot was like that.
We got married in 1960. A French lady made my wedding dress, and it was ordinary plain dress, that was all, with some freesia for me to hold, and that was lovely. We had the reception at the Trocadero restaurant. It was beautiful, lovely, lovely carpet as you went in, big chandelier. We had a lovely hors d'oeuvre, then a main meal, then we had champagne. Then after that we all walked back to the flat. We all had a chat and what have you, and then in the evening I had 40 people come into that little flat in Gesta Place, and they were all sitting on the stairs where I had my wedding cake and the brioche with everything in it for the evening meal. And the block of flats where I was a block of ordinary flats owned by the council, with the big gates on the door, and you had the courtyard. But you still didn't have any bathrooms, but you all had your own toilet, which was nice. And we used to have a blue plaque on that building in Gesta Place. This building is for the working class.
there's right down to the end of the street of Great Pulteney Street, going into Brewer Street, coming up a Bridle Lane, you had six houses and probably a dozen shops. It was a Georgian group of houses, and Silchester Southern Settler Estates decided to sell it to somebody or lease it to somebody, and all these people got together and formed a tenants association.
Alan Wakeman, who lived above me and who was like a brother, he and I had started writing songs in 1967, and Alan's always been the campaigning sort of person, and I was sort of drawn into his world of campaigning.
The early photographs you see of the Soho Festival, got this big banner saying London belongs to the people. And there was a big march called London Belongs to the People, and we took part in that as well. And that was our banner. We walked down the Regent Street, round Trafalgar Square. Because what was happening at that time, there was an office building plague going through the whole of London.
You know, it was absolutely wonderful to see the slogan, London Belongs to the People. That's what, in our differing ways and coming from our differing backgrounds, we all individually believe in. Because Soho's bang in the centre of London, and it was the only non-rich bit of the centre of London. You know, it was shabby.
When we heard the transformation of Piccadilly Circus planned, which was clearly going to affect Soho, which proposed a dual carriageway highway going under Piccadilly Circus, and we didn't want that. We thought that Piccadilly Circus was the heart of London.
Most of Soho, they thought, was past its use and should be pulled down completely, and something entirely new should happen there, called the Jericho Plan. That plan was actually passed, which covered the whole of Soho, or most of Soho, with a big platform with five towers and heliport on the top and somewhere underneath with the people.
Surely the property developers could see this. But of course they didn't. Property developers never see anything but the buck at the end of the road. And of course, with the support of Westminster City Council at the time, they thought they were going to push through this enormous development. Thankfully, common sense prevailed, and I like to think that we had a small part in it. We all contributed to saying, no, we are not prepared to accept this. We live here. There are 5,000 people in Soho. This is a residential part of London, which is what gives it its charm and perspective.
That particular building is where we live, and like all the rest, all the windows are walled up because they were going to try and get us out. We were living behind that and fighting to save the building.
And so we did what we could. We wrote about it, we screamed about it, we wrote songs about it, singing our Save Piccadilly campaign song, The Circus Keeps On Turning. We said no. And we said no in the best way that we as artists could.
And just when that was happening, the Act for Listed Buildings came in, and we fought to get these buildings listed, and we only got the houses listed, six of them. The rest went. The shops went, and the stables behind the big houses also went. But within those stables and those shops, we had something like about 60 different craftspeople, because Soho was full of craftspeople. You could get anything you wanted made in Soho. And I can quite confidently say that building is there because of Wendy, my wife, and myself, and the probably 15 or 16 people that really fought for that building. We held on so long that the property developer, who had taken the contract out from Sir Richard Sutton's estates, went bankrupt. And by this time, we had formed the Housing Association, and that was the first building we actually bought out of a grant.
first came on my own to Soho in 1982. My name is Lucia. I am 53 years old.
I've lived on the edge of Soho some 50 years, which is about the length of time that I've been involved in Soho. My name is Tim Miller.
So the first day I went down there, I went down Carnaby Street because that was the place to go if you were like a mod or a skinhead, and I was a skinhead at the time. And it wasn't anything like when you go up there with your friends and you're in a group. It was quite lonely. And lots of people, lots of tourists around, and didn't really know what I was doing or where I was going. And then I spotted a mod in a parka, and I thought, oh, follow him and see where he's going. And he went into the flea market. And at the top of the flea market, and there were lots of really cool kids hanging around, and somebody started chatting to me, one of the skinhead lads. Everyone was just really friendly, probably a little bit older than me, 2-3 years older. I was 16 at the time. And I was just wandering around with a friend. I didn't really know where I was doing. I'd had a massive row with my mum, had run away from home, was determined not to go back. And this was the only place I knew in London.
There were an awful lot of homeless kids on the street. Then people saw what they hadn't seen before, which was a lot of kids sleeping in against the hot air ducts outside the Savoy Hotel in winter, for instance.
My mate decided she was going home. She'd got the train back, and I was left up there on my own. Now, if it hadn't been for these people that I spoke to in the flea market, I probably would have been on the streets a lot sooner. But they took me sort of under their wing, and they were like, got to be careful in the West End because under 18, you're classed as juvenile at risk, so you'll get arrested. So you can't be seen loitering and just hanging around the streets like tourists do.
If they were under 16, there was a legal obligation to contact the police. So everyone claimed to be over 16. There was a group of small charities. Centrepoint was running this night shelter. The Soho Project, which was in Charing Cross Road, an office in Charing Cross Road, was working on the street. New Horizon was in Macklin Street in Covent Garden, but worked on the street round here.
And then one of the girls said to me, you know, where are you going? And I said, well, I haven't got anywhere to go. I said, I can't go back home, I've run away. So she said, well, come with us. And we ended up over Seven Sisters somewhere in some squat, which was like hideous. I was sort of squatting and hanging around, sleeping in cardboard boxes at Charing Cross Station, getting moved on by the police, being in doorways and getting moved on. And we used to, if that happened, we used to hang around in a cafe by Trafalgar Square. And that was always open really, really late. I was warned quite early on by a lot of the lads that not to hang around Piccadilly because of the people trying to get teenage prostitutes and rent boys and things. I really thought the old thing of the streets are paved with gold. Through one of the girls, I came across somewhere called Centrepoint. The first couple of nights I queued up there, I was right at the back of the queue. I didn't realise that you have to be there like 2 hours early to get at the front of the queue, and I couldn't get in. It was too late, and then you just have to wander the streets.
It opened at 8, and the team came in well before 7, after their ordinary day's work, and had to be ready to stay there till midnight.
So we used to wander around different cafes and things, and that's where Soho come into its own, really, because it's a real late night buzz about it. Lots of places are open till really stupid at o'clock. There's lots of people around, so there's safety in numbers as well.
The difficult thing was doing the gate, and the gate, you had to, through the old gate on Shaftesbury Avenue, people had to be interviewed in a very rudimentary style to try and see whether they wanted to come in to sell drugs or whether they wanted to come in because they were desperate or they wanted to come in because they were hungry.
It was really, really dark. It was absolutely teeming down with rain, and there was these big gates, quite ornate, but like they were trying to keep everything hidden, which I suppose along that road that you would do, the amount of tourists and things you get there. But the queue of people was really, really long, and they were mixtures of all ages and things. And in fact, probably as probably one of the youngest at that point, I didn't realise Centre Point was actually for young people. I thought it's for all homeless people, because I think what I didn't appreciate then was, though they might have looked older, they actually wasn't that much older than me.
Every young person who came in was interviewed. They were given a large mug of coffee or bottle. The main thing was to make them feel safe and make them feel welcome. But that was difficult because quite a lot were on the run from something.
So they used to take all your name and details and everything, and then they'd go indoors and you think, oh, and they'd say to you, oh, well, we're back in a little while, we just need to check some information. And then you're panicking because you're thinking, well, what are you checking? Are you checking with the police that I'm a teenage runaway? Are you going to find my mum and dad? You know, but I didn't really have anywhere else to go, so it was a case of putting up and waiting. Eventually they come back, so I was intimidated and scared in the beginning, without a doubt. I really thought they were going to ring my mum and I was going to get dragged back home, and I just couldn't go back there. When they come back and they say, oh yeah, you can come in, and then they come in, they used to give you a little bag with a toothbrush and little toothpaste and little bits and pieces. It was a big basement room. It was like a huge basement. It wasn't pretty. It was just a bog standard basic room with rows and rows of little camping beds with little pillows and blankets on them. There was at least a blanket on every one of them. And then there were showers as well. And I just remember sitting back and thinking, what on earth have I done? What have I let myself in for by coming in here? But actually, the staff in there were brilliant.
And after midnight, just a few stayed to give the people their breakfast and to see them safely off at 8 o'clock next morning.
You come out in the morning and you've been in this really dark basement, and you come out and it's light outside and it's grey and it's dull and it's cold and it's wet. And you're like, okay, where are we going to start wandering now? And they used to give you luncheon vouchers. So they used to give you luncheon vouchers, and you could go and get some food at a cafe or something. I can't even remember how much they were for. It weren't very much, but it was enough that you could get a sandwich. Different cafes used to have signs in the windows saying luncheon vouchers.
I think Centre Point did a lot of pioneering work, and that all came from Ken Leach and the people he knew.
I know that they were trying to persuade me to go home, that, you know, it's not as bad as you think it is. And actually, they were quite right. So, yeah, Soho was a really cool place to be.
Save Soho.
You've been listening to the voices of Rina Rotondo, Violet Trait, Claudio Mussi, Leslie Hardcastle, Michael Klein, Leslie Lewis, Lucia, and Tim Miller, with added field recordings made by the Radio Enrichment Group at Soho Parish School. Soho Then is a photo-based podcast produced by Claire Lynch and commissioned by the Photographers Gallery, a Soho-based public gallery dedicated to photography. Soho Then is financially supported by the National Lottery through the Heritage Lottery Fund and My Westminster Fund, with thanks to National Lottery players. Thanks for listening, and if you enjoyed the Soho Then podcast, don't forget to like and subscribe and tell your friends to listen too.